Well, good evening, Dr. Stan, back here at Radio Liberty with a voice that sounds a little bit better than it has in the past, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because, of course, we have with us on the line our very, very special friend and guest, Dr. Dennis Cuddy. Dennis, how are you tonight?
Oh, I'm hanging in there.
All right, fine. Well, you know, I just reading about that $87 billion that we're, of course, going to have to appropriate in addition to the $79 billion we've already spent for Iraq. And people are saying, well, you know, what's all the money going to go for? Well, we've got to rebuild the electric lines. Well, wait a minute now. They haven't been sabotaging all the electric lines. Well, we need to rebuild the electric lines in America. We don't have the money for it, but we're going to rebuild the electric grids over there, and we're going to remake their laws, and we're going to redesign their educational system. And Dr. Cuddy and I both talked to an administrator who's going over, a civilian administrator. They're actually employing thousands of administrators to go over to Iraq on a 5-year contract. So if you honestly believe that our boys are coming home, why, of course, you've been watching too much ABC, CBS, or NBC. What are your thoughts on that, Dennis?
Oh, yes, that's absolutely right. They initially had much less than 5-year contracts. Like you said, now they're up to 5 years. They figure that's going to be a minimum, probably. That $87 billion is going to be stretched out, too, because it's always wishful thinking. They had a segment on the evening news tonight where there's the one fellow who's in charge. He's an Iraqi, and he's been in charge and still is in charge of keeping the oil flowing, said, you know, it's just one battle after another. He actually has to have a gun and go run out along the lines and try and shoo off some people who are either going to set some sort of the explosive device or whatever, because obviously we cannot patrol every single square inch of those pipelines. And so the estimates originally had been within a year they would be geared back up to almost at least half of their production, but they're nowhere near that. And so that oil money that was going to come in, that I think Wolfowitz prior to the war said would fairly quickly start help paying for the rebuilding of Iraq, is just, it's not going to be there. And once again, you have the tours of duty of National Guard and others being extended, which the National Guard was never meant for that sort of purpose. You find that nerves are getting frayed. For example, just yesterday, our soldiers shot at some Iraqi police who we had trained, who were pursuing some thieves, and they were interviewing one of the policemen who survived, and he said, oh yeah, we waved, we told them who we were, but they kept shooting at us for about an hour anyway. And so the nerves are frayed, they're on edge, maybe one or two or three are killed a day, maybe 10, 20 are injured, plus we haven't begun to see the increase in expenses, because they're now having to have Bradley fighting vehicles accompany all sorts of convoys. The usual mileage on a Bradley vehicle is about 800 miles a year. They're already now doing 1,200 miles a month there, which means in the heat they're burning up the tires. Millions and millions and millions more dollars are going to be required just to provide the Kevlar, the tires, the replacement. The helicopter blades are being chewed up by the sand. This thing is going to cost far, far more than that $87 billion. And should I continue there?
Oh, no, let me just, I'm just going to make a point that I think that the big problem is that the American people don't understand the mentality of the Muslim religion. The Muslim religion, of course, feels that their ground is sacred, and when a foreigner comes into the ground, whether they like Saddam Hussein or not, they're going to come from Indonesia, they're going to come from Saudi Arabia and Qatar, they're going to come from Jordan, they're going to come from Afghanistan to fight the invaders, the Crusaders. And they're flooding in from all over to fight the Americans there, because this is the very essence of their religion. Now, if our leaders didn't understand that when they went over there, they certainly are not fit to lead. And if they did understand that, then they knew exactly what we were going to get into, and I think they did. And we're going to be there indefinitely.
Yes, absolutely. People, they keep saying even today, George Bush and the rest of them, well, you know, we're over there as a larger effort against terrorism because they hate what we have, which is freedom. Well, I'm sure people, the Wahhabis, would love to have some sort of theocratic universe where their religion controls everything, but that's not really what perpetrated the current round, the last several years of violence. Osama bin Laden's been around. Israel's been around since 1948. We've had freedom for a couple of hundred years, but this is really rather recent, and the primary reason is not only did we have a sort of deal to protect the autocratic elite of Saudi Arabia and other countries from about the 1970s, actually before the 1970s, but with Saudi Arabia really starting in the 1970s in full bore, but what happened was during the first Gulf War in 1991, we came over there. Osama had tried to persuade the Saudis, who are, that's his homeland, that they could, if Saddam decided to invade Saudi Arabia, they could repel them. But they didn't. The Saudis didn't go for that. They allowed the American troops in there, and the American forces stayed. And that's what primarily set off Osama bin Laden to launch these al-Qaeda attacks against us over the last couple of years. If he had been against our freedom, he would have started attacking us in 1979, 81, 80, you know, and so on. But he didn't. So this is something of a smokescreen, and I think when you have referred earlier to what Zbigniew Brzezinski said in his 1997 The Grand Chessboard, that really sort of gets to the heart of the matter. This is a grand chessboard. It's a geopolitical global game for defensive allies, for strategic positioning of forces, for oil, for a lot of different reasons. And Brzezinski, for example, was talking about this area, Afghanistan, Iraq, and the Middle East, and saying, he used words like, we will have to manipulate people. He would say that to get pipelines across here, to get military forces in certain places. And then he said there'll probably be some sort of Islamic reaction. They won't like this. They may engage in some sort of terrorist attacks against us. But, you know, we'll have to deal with that. And, you know, he went on and mapped out the whole historical background and the way he saw the future going.
But then, of course, he went on to say later in the book that, you know, of course, we wouldn't be able to mobilize public opinion in our multicultural society for a new foreign policy unless there was a direct, perceived direct external threat. Well, most Americans today perceive a direct external threat. Now, how did this come about? And I talked earlier today with Robert Sterling, a new book called Onward, Muslim Soldiers, and, of course, I asked the question, was there this radical form of Islam really prevalent throughout the Islamic world before 1980? No. I mean, certainly there were a few isolated areas, the Wahhabis in Saudi Arabia, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, but there was relatively little radical Islamic belief. Most Muslims wanted to live in peace. And then, of course, we toppled the Shah, and we brought the Ayatollah Khomeini to power. And, of course, when we did that, we, of course, set up a center of radical Islamic belief. And then, of course, we precipitated the war in Afghanistan by beginning to finance the Mujahideen, which were the holy warriors. And then we recruited them from all over the world, and we brought them to Afghanistan, and we indoctrinated them in this radical form of Islam. We put out $56 million, and if anybody wants the articles, we'll be glad to provide them, for textbooks to indoctrinate the youth of Afghanistan and Pakistan in radical Islamic belief. We created this whole radical Islamic movement. Why? Why the best enemy money could buy. And if anybody would like to see that article, you've read that article in the Washington Post, haven't you, Dennis?
Yes.
Isn't that amazing?
Absolutely. It's a very long article, but it's well worth reading the whole thing. And then, of course, if you provide these textbooks to these youngsters, who then 20 years later become Al-Qaeda members, I don't see why one should be surprised, because they've been trained to jihad against the infidels, whether it's Soviets coming to Afghanistan or American forces, as they consider it, trampling all over their holy land.
In Iraq. And of course, this is really what it's about today. And so there are people coming from Afghanistan and Pakistan who are indoctrinated with American textbooks in this radical form of Islam, killing American boys over there today. And we wonder why this is happening. It's happening because we flared up this whole thing. Of course, when the Al-Qaeda was initially financed, there was a great deal of evidence the CIA helped to finance. And we know that the CIA financed the Taliban from 1994 on. The terrible, wicked Taliban who were abusing women, and yet they were getting money from the United States. In fact, right up until the year 2001, when George Bush gave his speech on the 20th of September that year and said the United States is the largest source of humanitarian aid for Afghanistan, which, of course, was the Taliban.
Right, and two quick points there about flaring up. There was also a flaring up, according to a Brzezinski plan back in the 70s in Afghanistan. His idea was we would deliberately flare the Soviet action against Afghanistan during the 80s by contributing aid and so forth. And around 1979, 80, 81, that would lure the Soviets into that country. And then, of course, they would, you know, we would be able to further our foreign policy because of that. And in terms of the wicked Taliban against women, I remember President Bush's wife was saying, "Oh, this is horrible, and this is one reason we have to go over there and liberate the people." But then, shortly after our conquering of the Taliban, supposedly conquering of the Taliban, somebody asked Hamid Karzai, the leader that we sort of imposed upon them, also a consultant for Unocal Oil, whether they were going to continue with Islamic law, which would include the Islamic law's treatment or mistreatment of women. He said, "Oh, sure, absolutely, we'll continue that, but, you know, we don't hear about that anymore."
Isn't that amazing how they focus our attention on this when they want us, of course, to back the administration, and then, of course, when we're, of course, now that we've totally disrupted that country and more chaos, and the women are still having to wear their crazy garb there with a little slit for their eyes.
I
never mentioned it, right. And of course, you know, of course, talk about oppression of women. Saudi Arabia has been famous for that for years, and women are never even allowed to go out without a man with them, and they always have to wear the veil and cover themselves. And I mean, the wives beat the husbands, and, you know, they still stone people there, women for adultery, and behead men regularly in Saudi Arabia. But you don't hear that focused on the media day after day, because, well, at least not yet. Probably when we go to war with Saudi Arabia, then the big propaganda machine will turn on, and they will be talking about how terribly the people are oppressed in Saudi Arabia. But of course, they'll measure that. They manipulate America through control of the media. And it's amazing, if you read, as I do, half a dozen newspapers and half a dozen magazines, it's almost as if somebody gives an order and the same article or the same theme is carried out in all the American media, almost as if somebody was orchestrating what the American people hear, see, and believe.
That's correct. As you said, the husbands continue to beat the wives in Saudi Arabia and other standards like that. One of the things I've tried to emphasize, whether it's under Clinton, Bush, the first President Bush, Reagan, whoever, is a lot of our problem is perception by others of what they consider with some validity to be a double standard. For example, we were invading Iraq because of weapons of mass destruction. We didn't really think they actually had nuclear weapons. They'd want them, but it was primarily chemical and biological, the 25,000 liters of anthrax and so forth they supposedly had. Well, to these people, though, who are there and who are knowledgeable and who have had to live in Iraq during a war against Iran, which both sides used chemical weapons against each other, when they hear Americans talk about that, they say, what kind of double standard is this? You people actually provided us with the material to make these chemical weapons. You knew in the 80s we were using it against Iran, and you weren't talking about invading us then. And so there's a double standard there. It goes back to Noriega and Panama and Saddam in the first Gulf War. We invaded I'm not going to spend much time on this, but we invaded Panama because Noriega had violated our domestic law. And so Saddam says, well, look, you know, the Kuwaitis are violating Iraqi domestic law by slant drilling. And we say, oh, but, you know, Noriega was a dictator. He didn't allow democracy there. Well, in Kuwait, they dissolved the parliament. So, you know, the autocrats rule that place too. Every point they go along, justification for going after Noriega, and I think he's a, you know, he's an evil man, and that, you know, it's the world in Panama is probably better off that he's not in control. But the other nations of the world see this sort of double standard, which we don't get in our media, because, as you said, somebody gives a signal, and all of the media, the press, start giving a particular line, which, as we've discussed in the past, goes right back to, among other things, Cecil Rhodes. If you'll remember his plan, his secret society, the Society of the Elect, they were to penetrate economics, politics, journalism, and education. Journalism was a key component, and they got their people in various positions and editorships over the past century. And so the example I give is when somebody says, oh, so the power elite told these guys to fly into these, the 19 hijackers to fly into the buildings. What I try to say is they try and keep themselves one step removed. They don't call up and tell Mohammed Atta, okay, go fly into these buildings. But they create situations from which they can anticipate that either that'll happen or, you know, passenger train or some sort of terrorist act will occur. And so this goes back to the orchestrating of the media can be seen, for example, in gun control and reports about students using guns in schools. One of the students down in the South, was in Mississippi or somewhere, who shot the other students in the school was stopped by a teacher who got a gun out of a car, came back, and said, drop the gun or I'll shoot you. Out of about 900 newspapers that covered that story, only about a dozen put that in the story. The rest of them just said, student shoots other students with guns, and then some editor writes an editorial about we need more gun control. Now, that didn't happen because, you know, David Rockefeller or whoever calls up 900 editors. He doesn't have to do that. These people with this perspective over many, many years have been in place in editorships in various newspapers around the country, and that is their mentality. That is their worldview. Nobody has to call them up. They automatically think and write like that.
Of course, I sometimes think that maybe they're hired because they think and write like that.
That's right. That's why they're in that position. They have that attitude. They're put in that position, so at the last minute, the power elite does not actually physically have to pick up a phone and tell them, okay, tomorrow write this.
Well, you know, there's so many fascinating things that are going on today, and it's just so vitally important that people begin to realize how we are being manipulated. And as I always say at the beginning of my program, reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. And what we're trying to do, of course, is teach our listeners to begin to think on their own, begin to challenge, begin to read several newspapers, and of course begin to see how our reality is being manipulated. At that point, then of course they can be free.
That's absolutely right, and that's why they're dumbing down the youngsters in the schools, and not only dumbing down in terms of their lack of knowledge of history, because as Santayana said, if you don't know history, you're doomed to repeat the mistakes of the past. But in terms of their values, because values are very critical to an acceptance, what they want is, as we discussed before, I think the ultimate plan is a synthesis of Eastern communism, Western capitalism into a world socialist government. Now, to get people to buy socialism, what they've had to do is condition them through the schools, other ways too, but through the schools, beginning with John Dewey, and after the break, maybe we can pick it up.
I believe you've got about 30 seconds. Go ahead.
Okay, well, John Dewey in 1960 wrote Democracy in Education, where he said if you're a dependent person, you're normal, but if you're independent, you have a form of, quote, insanity. And what he said was that we were going to have socialism. We may have call it liberalism, but it would be socialism because the group is what's important, not the individual, not the independent person.
In fact, that's exactly what this whole church growth movement is. We did a wonderful program last night about that. The group becomes the important thing, not the individual. We'll be right back here at Radio Liberty. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our special guest this evening, Dr. Dennis Cuddy. And I don't want to get off onto the church growth movement, although we had a wonderful program on that last night. But I want you to realize, of course, that the whole idea is to do away with individualism and get into group thought. And that's why in the seeker-friendly churches, you are told, if you don't want to go into a small group, we don't want you in this church. And once you get into that group with consensus thinking, your individualism begins to dissipate. You begin becoming part of the group, dependent upon the group, exposing yourself, addressing yourself emotionally to the group. And, of course, this is how you begin changing people's attitude. It's the technique that was developed during by the Chinese communists in Korea, then picked up by our psychologists, and now being applied in churches all across America. And the average individual, even attending these churches, good God-fearing people, have no idea how they're playing games with their minds.
That's absolutely right. And there are several facets to it. As I said, Dewey created this mentality within the progressive education movement, which later on he applied it to religion, and it was mainly through education at Columbia Teachers College, which by the early 50s was putting out about a third of all the principals and superintendents in the 160 largest cities, school systems around the nation, so that by the early 60s they were actually down to the classroom level controlling most of the schools of the whole country. And they were able then to switch from what's called the cognitive or academic basics, reading, writing, math, to the affective domain, social relationships and feelings. So that you couldn't fail Johnny because it hurt his self-esteem, and we had to learn to get along with each other. You had the National Training Labs putting out efforts on sensitivity training, which they literally called in one of their documents brainwashing. And the idea was to condition students through a certain facilitated process, Socratic questioning regarding their values, cooperative learning, they may call it. They even would give group grades on your various outcome-based education forms and diplomas. They would say he's a cooperative learner. He knows how to get along with others and so forth. So you had a facilitated consensus, and this was applied also in what has come to be called school to work, and creating the international or global citizen was very important in all this. And they even piloted smart cards so that if you had certain academic skills, you could, Santa Cruz, you would be recognized in Belgium as an electrician or whatever. And this all goes into what's called a portfolio. And as you indicated, the Chinese started, they called it the Dangan, D-A-N-G-A-N, and that was your worth to the state, to the society. It's not just the communists, the left and so forth. In Hitler's Nazi Germany, they called it the Arbeitsbuch. You had to take this thing around and be able to show it your credentials, your academic skills and so forth, and your value to the state. And so there's been a big push through this recent school-to-work movement along those lines as well, because they're literally trying to create citizens of the world. In fact, in some of my books, The Globalist, I put Clinton saying how he feels he is a citizen of the world. And that's not just a phrase. When you say citizen, that means you have certain, quote, responsibilities. If you're a citizen of the United States, you have to obey laws. So if you're a citizen of the world, ultimately, you're going to have to obey international law.
Hold that thought right there. We're going to... Okay, fine. Well, our guest this evening is Dr. Dennis Cuddy, and we've just been talking during the break about, of course, how they're using education to mold the minds of our youth, to change their attitude, to prepare them to be for the new world order, the new world religion that are coming. And believe me, these people really do. In fact, our producer brought me something that has been put out by the Gorbachev Foundation talking about how, of course, this new universal religion is going to come along and how we're going to have to identify those fundamentalists, those people who are real troublemakers, and eliminate them. That's the word, eliminate them. And, of course, they really do intend to do that. That's the people who don't want to go along, who really probably believe in the divinity of Jesus Christ. Well, how could that be right when all of the religions have have a different deity. We've just got to eliminate those people, those fundamentalists who have absolute beliefs. There really are people out there that look at it that way. Well, let's sort of get back to a discussion of, we digressing a little bit about what's going on in Iraq, and perhaps you had a series of questions that you'd answered or put up about what happened on September 11th, and then, of course, maybe the answers to some of those questions.
Right. And one article that I sent out, I had put forward some questions which we've talked about to some extent in the past, such as why did some top Pentagon officials on September 10th of 2001 suddenly cancel their travel plans for the next morning, apparently because of security concerns, and some other points were made, and then someone in response to that wrote and said, well, why don't you, you know, give us some answers instead of just raising questions. Tell us what you think actually happened. And so what I think happened, and we've been through the what they knew about Project Bojinka and so forth, but
well, you better explain to our listeners what Project Bojinka was, because many of them may not know. Certainly if they were to read the public media, they would never find out that.
No, they wouldn't know that. No, Project Bojinka was after the 1993 bombing, Ramzi Youssef, one of the masterminds of the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, eventually went to the Philippines with Abdul Hakim Murad. Murad was caught shortly thereafter, not too long thereafter, 1995. Ramzi got away briefly, but they got him later. But Murad, on his laptop, which he tried to go back, but when he went back, the police were...
There was a fire in the apartment,
right,
is what happened. So
right,
they left and they came back again.
Right, they came back and the police had it. And in Project Bojinka was the sort of first-level plan of hijacking planes and blowing them up over the ocean. But there was a second level of plans as well, which Rafael Garcia, who's CEO of the Mega Group in the Philippines, a computer company who helped decipher that, was fairly clear about how that plan involved also hijacking airplanes and flying them in this country into the World Trade Center, the Sears Tower, Transamerica Building, White House, and so on. And so this was a plan that was well known to our people. Rafael Garcia said he passed it on. I forget the guy's name. I think it's Hobson, Bob Hobson, something like that. I've got it in my book, Cover Up, an FBI agent. Now, we know that sort of went up the ladder because in 1998, Dale Watson, who was head of counterintelligence for the FBI, is testifying before Congress and saying, oh, yes, I'm very familiar with Project Bojinka, and don't worry, we've got things under control. We're coordinating with the CIA and NSA and so forth. So they're very familiar with that.
And, now and this is a plan to hijack planes and crash them into the World Trade Center.
Right, right. And so a couple of months prior to September 11th, you have in a backgrounder Bill Gertz writing basically this. Project Bojinka involves hijacking these airliners and crashing them into these buildings. And both you and I, after the event, talked to Bill Gertz, and he sort of shuffled around and said, oh, well, that was a mistake, and so on, but he still maintained it in his international version of the Washington Times.
And if any of our listeners would like to see that, we have the original backgrounder that was republished by the United Airlines flight attendants, and so in July, 2 months before the September 11th attack.
Right, and so Project Bojinka is well known and what it involved, and the FBI knew about it. And so what I think happened is they kept getting more and more information, so that by August 6th of 2001, in that CIA briefing, which they're deliberately and adamantly refusing to release the details of, I think that came to the fore even more, and that somewhere in there it mentions a hijacking, possibly in the future, the near future soon, and within the U.S. And I think that's what they don't want us to know.
I think also the thing is, why didn't the president arm the pilots? Why didn't he insist on the doors being locked? Why didn't he insist on them being reinforced as the GAO had recommended? Why didn't he put armed National Guard people on the plane to protect the American people? If he knew there was going to be a hijacking, why didn't he protect the American people? Or maybe there was another agenda. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and as horrible it is to contemplate, we know that the administration has classified the information dealing with the August 6th briefing, CIA briefing of the president, where they told him that the terrorists were going to hijack a plane here in the United States, or several planes. We don't know what we were told other than planes were going to be hijacked in the United States. And then, of course, the month before that, the FAA had actually removed the regulation that had allowed some pilots to carry weapons. So just in July, the month before this initial briefing, 2 months before the attack, for some strange reason, at that time, certain pilots could carry weapons, and the FAA put out a directive, no pilot can carry a weapon. Now, they started in 1995, Operation Bajinka in 1996. They started taking marshals off the planes, so there were no armed marshals on the planes. What we should have done at that time, what the president should have done, if he really wanted to stop an attack, was number one, to immediately put out a directive countering the FAA and saying all pilots can be armed. Number two, order the doors and the planes, the cockpit door, to be locked all the time. Number three, they can be reinforced very readily, as they have with many of them. I take about 15 minutes with a drop bolt on there. And four, of course, put as an emergency procedure, put National Guard on the planes. None of those things were done. And if you really thought there was going to be a major attack in America, why wouldn't you do that sort of thing?
Well, they keep saying, the administration, well, yeah, we knew something big and soon, but we thought it was outside the U.S. And so that's why I think they're really holding on fast to the details of that August 6th briefing, because I think in there it mentions hijacking and the increasing likelihood of within the U.S., and I can't think of any other reason why these top Pentagon officials on September 10th would suddenly cancel their plans for the next morning, because they're going to be flying within the U.S. Same thing with Mayor Willie Brown, who is supposed to fly the morning of the 11th from San Francisco to New York. He is called up late at night, not 2 in the afternoon, but late at night. I mean, you know, maybe he's asleep. So this had to be important for somebody to call him up around 10 o'clock or so at night and give this warning, and he was to fly within the U.S. Now, if this big alert that they're looking for is going to happen in France or somewhere, they wouldn't be calling up Willie Brown at 10 o'clock at night just because he's going to fly from San Francisco to New York. So I'm thinking here towards the last, there was increasingly an awareness that this big and soon that Dick Cheney kept referring to, we knew something big was going to happen soon, they had increasing information that it was going to be hijacking and within the U.S. And that's what they don't want the people to be aware of, because as soon as the people start saying, you knew that, they start saying, two things. Number one, where was the preventive contingency planning? Where was the military helicopter on standby alert in New York City, at least, because they had already tried to blow up the World Trade Center in 1993? And secondly, what Kristen Breitwiser said, if the public had just been told, like we are being told now, with these, you know, red and orange and whatever code alerts, that there could be, just that there could be a terrorist attack, then all of those people, including Kristen's husband in the second tower, as soon as that first tower was hit, they would have said, maybe this is that big and soon, so we better immediately evacuate this building.
Well, you know, of course, I know you're acquainted with Eleanor Hill's testimony, but for our listeners out there, if you have a computer, type in Eleanor Hill. She was the director of the Select Committee investigation, and she testified on the 18th of September of the year 2002. And what she said is, you know, they're talking a lot. The administration is saying, oh, we thought that this was going to be an attack overseas. We were 98.5% sure it would be overseas. She said they knew it was going to be here. All of the evidence pointed that it was going to be here. Furthermore, the evidence pointed towards an attack on our skyscrapers. They specifically mentioned an attack on the World Trade Center. That testimony, of course, totally ignored by the media and deleted from the final report. That, of course, even the final report, which had very little in it, was carefully censored by the administration. Why? Because they cannot allow the American people to even suspect the terrible, horrible, horrible truth.
That's absolutely right. There's a lot of the testimony that Kristen Breitwiser's is worth looking at, not only for what I said and Eleanor Hill's too, But for unanswered questions, and that's what I try to do in the first article I had out about a month ago, one of the things that that Kristen said was, how did the agents, government agents, know the details of a phone conversation between the terrorists a week before September 11th unless we were already monitoring them? Nobody in the government has come forward and explained that.
Yeah, of course, well, of course, they don't want to explain that, but they were monitoring all of the terrorist conversations through Echelon. They do this by computer. They monitor every telephone call, every fax, every email, every electronic communication anywhere in the world by computer. And then, they, of course, they run this to computers and pick up certain keywords. And if there's a question, then they have people listen to them. I'm sure, though, that they had people listening directly to Osama bin Laden. They were listening to his telephone calls. They knew he called his mother a couple of days beforehand and said, you won't hear from me for some time. Something big is going to happen, what, 2 days? Something
in 2 days.
Like that. Right.
Right. Same thing with the NSA intercepts the day before. They and everybody, I mean, even the establishment media and press says, oh, yes, the National Security Agency had a couple of intercepts September 10th, but golly, unfortunately, they just didn't get that translated and up the line until September 12th. All right, now, if you stop right there and think about it, that just doesn't make any sense at all. I mean, even if you buy their reasoning, it doesn't make sense, because what would have to happen is an employee of the NSA is sitting there on the 10th. Okay, here comes the conversation. Yeah, all right, we intercept it, and there it is, and it's sitting on my table. All right, now I should be translating it, but let's go along with the game they're playing here and say I don't translate it for some reason. All right, now here we are, the morning of the 11th. All right, even the establishment media says at 9:53, on the morning of the 11th, there is another NSA intercept saying another plane is going to hit. This is the terrorists talking to each other. Another plane is going to hit. All right, the person intercepts that, translates it immediately, gives it to George Tenet. He runs over, gives it to Donald Rumsfeld, and Rumsfeld, by 12:05, just 2 hours later, is waving it around and talking about it. All right. Now, at this point, what we're supposed to believe is that employee who had that intercept on the 10th, he's still sitting around. You know, it's still on his desk. An hour goes by, 5 hours goes by, 24 hours goes by. And then on the 12th, he picks this thing up and says, hey, let's translate this and see what this says. I mean, it just, you know, is unbelievable.
Well, I think that they think that the Americans are pretty gullible. It's sort of like the story about Pearl Harbor when George Catlett Marshall knew the attack was coming, and of course he could have picked up a telephone and called Pearl Harbor and warned them. He could have picked up contacted them by radio. Instead, he sent a Western Union cablegram, and of course, half an hour after the attack, and all the Americans are dead. Why, here comes a little boy on a bicycle, riding the bicycle up to General Kimmel's house to deliver the cablegram that says the Japanese are going to attack you at dawn. You know, if you believe that happened by accident, you have to be incredibly naive.
Right, and their excuse was, well, we decided to send it that way by Western Union, whatever, because, you know, we didn't want the Japanese to intercept it, no. Well, why not? I mean, what would be the worst that could happen? The Japanese would know we were onto them and turn around and not kill 3,000 or so of our soldiers? I mean, you know, I mean, so that happened. I mean, isn't that good that we prevented the war and the attack? So, you know, even that doesn't make sense.
Well, of course, I have, in fact, it's my latest newsletter, and I found this in Secretary of War Stimson's diary at Yale University, and the, you know, of course, notation on the 25th of November where he says, you know, we had this meeting at the White House today, and there was Hull and Stark and Marshall and myself and the president, and the question was raised, you know, when will the Japanese attack? Maybe next Monday. It'll be a surprise attack. That's the way they always attack. And then, you know, what should we do? Well, the one thing is we want to get into the war. How can we get into the war and get the Japanese to fire the first shot and have as little damage to ourselves as possible? In other words, we want to get into the war. We want the Japanese to fire the first shot and as little damage as possible. And then, of course, that was what Pearl Harbor was. We only lost 3,000 lives, sort of like on September 11th. We only lost 3,000 lives.
Yeah, he says we want to maneuver them into to taking the first shot, so we have an excuse to go on. And then what you find out later is that the various intercepts that we had early on just, you know, are very clear that FDR and everybody knew that this was going to happen. And Stimson, even later on, as Secretary of War with John J. McCoy and others under him, thought that they had done the right thing. Same thing with the First World War. We had known in advance what was going to happen there, and so we sort of lure people. It's sort of like April Glaspie during that first Gulf War, where she goes over and tells Saddam. Saddam says, "What if we invade Kuwait?" And she says, "Well, it's none of our business." And then, lo and behold, he invades, and we say, "Oh, well, now we got you. We have a justification."
Now, of course, for our listeners, April Glaspie was the American ambassador to Iraq at the time, and Saddam Hussein contacted her and said, "You know, how do you feel about my attacking Iraq because of, you know, a military solution to this problem of stealing our oil?" And her remark was, as Dr. Cuddy said, so the tragedy is we gave him a go-ahead, and as soon as he did it, now we had a justification for war. And the tragedy is this is what all of these wars are about. Now, if any of you doubt that the war, current war with Iraq, was planned back in 1998 by Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney, you go to their website, and it's newamericancentury.org, pull down their website, look at the letters from the Project for the New American Century in 1997 and 1998. There's a statement of principles, 1997, a letter in 1998 to President Clinton calling for war with Iraq. In the year 2000, they published a report calling for war with Iraq a year before the attack, the terrorist attack. So this was all decided long ahead of time. We needed an excuse, and September 11th gave us the excuse. Please, if you're offended by what I say, if it seems too horrible to contemplate, go to their website and find out if what I'm telling you the truth. If it is, then understand we are in World War III, and you will never again live in a nation at peace.
That's an important point to see how the groundwork, as you said, is laid for these things in advance, and how, as I said, situations are created from which we can anticipate certain responses, and then the paralete has their goals furthered. It's like Sir Edward Grey sort of luring the Germans into supporting the Austro-Hungarian Empire after the Serbian ultimatum was delivered.
That was in 1914. That's how we got in the First World War.
Right, this delivered. And then you can get an idea, I think it was like November 21, the Stimson entry into his diary in World War II was November 25 of 1941.
Right.
If you look 4 days before that, you'll find an entry in the congressional record where they have just appropriated $50,000, the federal government, for a cemetery at Pearl Harbor. Now, you got to figure they know something's going to happen pretty soon.
Yeah, well, they knew there were a lot of people were going to die. They knew a lot of people were going to die at the World Trade Center. And, in fact, of course, if you read Dr. Cuddy's book, September 11th, Prior Knowledge, that's the title, isn't it?
Yes.
And we carry that book. You'll find the little boy, little Pakistani boy, in New York, in classroom a week before the attack, gets up in class, points out the window at the Twin Towers, and he says, "Those won't be there a week from now." And, of course, after the attack, sure enough, why the FBI investigates it, finds that everybody on the street knew there was going to be an attack. How could everybody on the street know there was going to be an attack? And why the American people didn't know, the Intelligence Committee didn't know. I've talked to Dr. Garth Nicholson, who I really do believe, and he told me he was notified weeks ahead of time by people with an intelligence he knows, he's worked with, that the attack was coming. On the Pentagon on September 11th, he contacted people at the highest levels of our government. Of course, you know that Dr. David Shippers was notified by people in intelligence that the attack was coming on Lower Manhattan about that time. He went to Washington, D.C. Nobody would talk to him. Obviously, we're not getting the full story, and none of these people are being called before these investigating committees.
Right. Now, what we get and what the public is given are isolated bits. And what's helpful is if they put the two things together. For example, what you just said. All right, let's take one of the bits of information that we know. One of the bits of information we know, for example, from Stephen Emerson, let's say, in his American Jihad, Jihad in America, the video and the book and so on, is that way, way back in the 1980s, we knew about the Iranians training terrorists to hijack planes, fly them into buildings, and that in the U.S., they had safe houses and money and false identity papers and so forth. And Emerson goes around in the 80s and the 90s, and he's secretly videotaping these things. And Joseph Bodansky is writing some similar things as head of the U.S. House of Representatives Task Force on Counterterrorism and Unconventional Warfare. And so we have this picture, all right, that these groups, these terrorist groups, these cells are here, money's being raised, and we're aware of what they're doing and the false identity papers and so on, all right? That's one bit of information. All right, let's skip to another bit of information. The other bit of information is, just as you said, that when they investigated after September 11th of 2001, they find out that this little boy in Utrecht High School in Brooklyn had looked out the window of his classroom in a heated discussion, told the classmates and the teacher on September 6th, he said, "You see those two buildings, those two towers, next week they're not going to be there. A lot of the youngsters on the 11th, September 11th, bring their cameras to school. The police afterwards have trouble finding out who had first-hand knowledge and second-hand knowledge because the news, the information was so pervasive." All right, now let's link those two things up. If we're monitoring these people, including these cells, including Brooklyn, including everywhere under the sun, if we got maps of where our Al-Qaeda, the 25 or 30 training camps are in the U.S., if we've got all that, and you link it up with the fact that this information is just like all over the place in Brooklyn, it staggers the imagination that we didn't put those two things together, and somebody in the Brooklyn area didn't just stumble upon the fact that this September 11th attack was going to occur. That's not believable.
Well, I think, you know, the thing that every one of our listeners knows is that immediately after the attack, the government arrested 1,200 Islamic people.
Right.
Now, there are 6 million Muslims in America, but they picked out 1,200. They knew where they were.
Right.
If they were living here illegally, they obviously knew where they were here illegally the day before September 11th. Why did they wait till the day after September 11th? And many of these people are still in prison in America. Now, if they were simply here illegal immigrants, why not ship them out? If they were terrorists, how did they know they were terrorists? And I believe that the reason we haven't had any more terrorist attacks in this country is because they have this whole system thoroughly infiltrated. We know, for instance, when they had the Communist Party here, they had the Communist Party infiltrated. We know that when they had the militia movement here in America, they had that infiltrated. The FBI talked about the danger of the Christian Identity Movement. If you read the book, The Secret Life of Bill Clinton by Ambrose Evans Pritchard, why you'll find that the Christian Identity camp at Elohim City, almost everybody there was a government agent of some sort. This was the headquarters of Christian Identity in Oklahoma. So it would be ridiculous to say that they didn't infiltrate the American Muslim movement. They knew who the terrorists were. They arrested them. But we can't tell the American people that, because if we told them we knew who all the terrorists were, that's why we've not had any more terrorist attacks. Why, of course, that would mean that we knew what was going to happen on September 11th. And I think Kristen Breitweiser said it best when her testimony on the 18th of September of last year, and if you want that testimony, it's up on the web, or you can get it through my ministry, as well as Eleanor Hill's testimony. You should have these things and read them and help us get the information out. But Kristen Breitweiser is pointing out that within 2 hours, that's 2 hours of the attack, why the FBI is at the restaurants where some of the hijackers ate, at the neighborhoods where they lived, at the flight schools where they trained. Now, let's assume that the FBI had no knowledge there was going to be an attack, had no knowledge who any of these people were because they were living here in our society, completely independent. They had not aroused any suspicion. How could it be that within 2 hours they were able to go to the restaurants where they ate, the neighborhoods where they lived, the flight schools where they trained? If you can explain that, that just defies my imagination. I suspect that they did know exactly who some of these people were, and they're lying to us.
Well, Robert Wright, Special Agent, FBI Agent Robert Wright in Chicago, practically said as much in his lawsuit against the FBI, where, according to the report that was issued in one of the major press accounts about his lawsuit, he had indicated that it was simply a matter of some of these FBI agents knew who these people were. He got that impression that they were just waiting so they could round them up after some incident occurred. And so that would explain their knowledge, I think, of what happened right after September 11th. As you said, if they can round all these people, 1,200 or whatever, up almost immediately, it staggers the imagination that they couldn't find out what even little children all over Brooklyn knew in the Muslim community. I mean, that's just unbelievable that just by accident they wouldn't have come across some child, you know, talking to a friend about, oh, yeah, don't forget to bring your camera to school tomorrow to film the attack.
The whole story is so incredible, and yet, of course, you're never going to hear this discussed on ABC, CBS, and NBC. You're never going to, you haven't been invited on to major television, have you, Dennis?
No way.
Gee, for some reason, I haven't either, but at least we have a small voice, and we have people all across America who are at least hearing some of the truth, and our job is to get the truth out. Your job out there in the listening audience, if you'd like to get a copy of the tape of this program and circulate it, copy it, you have our permission to do that, and I'm sure Dennis's permission as well. America is in real trouble because, of course, we have leaders who really believe what they're doing is right. They believe in an American empire. How are we going to create this wonderful new empire, this wonderful new world government? Why America has to lead it. Now, you've got all these Muslim countries out there. They're not going to want to go along with this. So we've got to remove their leadership and put in people that we can trust who will go along with this whole agenda. And we've got to put people in positions of authority if we're going to establish this world government and the new world religion. We're going to have to change people's attitude towards God and towards their traditions and towards their nation. And we've got to do away with this idea of nationality and patriotism and replace it with this idea that we're all citizens of the world. And then we can have this wonderful world government. Of course, the major force behind this is the Antichrist himself, because, of course, you cannot divorce what's happening today politically and without understanding the spiritual forces that energize this whole movement. What would your thoughts on that be, Dennis?
That's absolutely right. The movement towards the world government, as Barry Goldwater said about the trilaterals, and they're not alone, is they want not only social, economic, and political control, but ecclesiastical as well. And so John Dewey, who I mentioned earlier, he wrote, co-authored the first Humanist Manifesto in 1933, and right after that, in 1934, he wrote a book called A Common Faith, where he said dogmatic Christianity will have to surrender. What he meant was we can't have any of these dogmatic, fundamentalist, moral, absolutist types around. And that not only applies to Christians, but to Muslims as well. And so my thinking is, like we were talking about before, and you mentioned the word consensus and facilitating, is that's the process that's going on in Iraq now. They're trying to drive the Shiites and the Sunnis to a consensus under the guise of saying once you people start to agree and so on, we'll get out of here. Of course, we're not going to get out of there. But we're telling them that that's what they need to do. And the reason they're doing that is because the larger plan, as not only Cecil Rhodes said, but Zbigniew Brzezinski too, is that to get to the world government, they'll have to link up regions, and the regions will have to be stable. Now, they have a sort of stable North America, a sort of stable Europe, and that's why the Bosnian effort was key to that, why we had to go into Bosnia as well, and a sort of stable Asia for the time being. But the two primary areas left in third, if you count South America, what's happening with oil and Venezuela and so on, would be Africa, and we've seen a little bit of that starting with Liberia. But mainly their focus is on the Middle East. They're trying this process through a sort of Delphi technique and strategic interest. There's a whole lot of things involved, oil and economics and so on. But what they have to do in terms of religion is get rid of any people with very, very strongly held beliefs. And you see that in this country. Even Charles Schumer, senator, is saying for court nominees, anybody with strongly held religious beliefs need not apply.
And, of course, what they're doing, they're getting television to all the homes there, all throughout Baghdad with dish television. And, of course, the television has a tremendous impact on people. They're going to change the educational system over there so we can begin to indoctrinate the youth with these ideas of internationalism and, of course, doing away with destroying their belief in God and patriotism. Now, whether they'll succeed, I don't know. You know, the Muslims have very strongly held beliefs, but I never thought they could destroy the individuality of the South African. When I lived there, I thought that they would fight to the very end for, you know, their system and their society, and, of course, they caved in totally. And it was television that did it. Perhaps they'll be able to accomplish it in the Middle East. Never underestimate your enemies, because, of course, they have supernatural intelligence energizing them.
Well, television was key, because there was a study actually done, I think it's a Canadian, who said just prior to the introduction of television in South Africa and Canada and, you know, several other places, crime was very low. Then once television was introduced, crime skyrocketed. And so television is a very key component. And I know we don't have time, but I'll just mention Edward Bernays in 1928 became the chief advisor to William Paley, a CFR member, when he began CBS. And that same year, Bernays, who was Sigmund Freud's nephew, wrote a book called Propaganda, saying we literally are an invisible government, and we know how to manipulate you. And he was the father of public opinion. He would literally pay people in the garment district a few years later to come out with fashions that were in red and green, because he had been paid by Lucky Strike, who was coming out with a regular red and a green menthol pack. And so he used the media and so forth and advertising to condition the population. And so through television, this is extremely important today as well.
Well, I think that they know exactly what they're doing. Reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. We're just about out of time. Do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners tonight, Dennis?
Yes. As usual, I emphasize prayer to God is first, because nothing is going to be accomplished without prayer to God. Secondly, though, we cannot sit around and do nothing. We have to participate. We have to organize, do our individual best, but then communicate with others. Let them understand the process, not just the individual events that are happening, but the process that's going on, and rally support that way. Educate individuals through listening to Radio Liberty, communicate through letters to the editor and other grassroots organizations, and not just assume that because the Bible, and the Bible is correct, there will eventually be an Antichrist, but we are supposed to occupy. We are supposed to be involved. The apostles could have just sat around and said, oh, well, let's just wait for Jesus' return, but they didn't. They went out and actively preached the gospel, and we need to tell people what's happening today as well, so that there can be at least some resistance, because H.G. Wells said, you know, many will die protesting against this new world order.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a fascinating hour. As always, I learn something every time I have you on. God bless you. Thanks so much, and give my best to Peggy.
Okay, you too.
All right, bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I hope you realize, of course, you've had a unique opportunity to hear one of the wisest people that I know. Dr. Dennis Getty is a professor at the college. He worked in the Reagan administration, Department of Education. He's a researcher now, and certainly we're fortunate to have him here on Radio Liberty. And of course, hope many of you out there will want to join the Radio Liberty family and help us as we continue expanding our coverage across America. We ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival. We ask you to pray for my ministry, for our provision and our protection. So until Monday, when we'll be back with you once again, and hopefully my voice will be back to normal. Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us right now, from Hanford, California, Bernadine Smith. Hi, how are you doing, Bernadine?
Well, I'm doing fine, Stan. It sounds like you are probably overworking yourself, and it's hard on the voice.
Well, no, actually, I've had laryngitis, but you should have heard me a week ago. I sounded like a frog. Now I just sound like I just swallowed a frog, but I'm getting better. So, of course, I'm going to let you do a lot of talking tonight. So.
Yeah, yeah. So, well, I've been there, too. I know what it's like.
Bernadine's on the front lines of the battle to try to keep the right to keep and bear arms. And she has really done a yeoman's job, and she's got some ideas about what we can do. You see, we're moving very rapidly towards a dictatorship, and whether you know it or not. And, of course, what they want to do is, of course, centralize all power in Washington, D.C., federal control of the local police. And, of course, they want to do away with the local sheriffs. They want to do away with local control completely in the name of fighting terrorism. Oh, we've got, of course, to, take away the controls to fight these terrorists. And yet, of course, they don't control our lower borders. They're not trying to do that. They're certainly not arming the airline pilots. What do they know that we don't? They've done everything they can. There's 150 pilots so far that have been cleared to carry weapons. They're waiting until just now to put more air marshals on the planes. They were going to start taking them off. Now they talk about putting another 5,000 on. If we needed the air marshals, why didn't we have them? Why did they wait until now? There's been not one major terrorist attack in the United States since the anthrax attack, which they knew was coming because Dick Cheney started on Cipro the night of September 11th, so he knew it was coming. He just didn't tell anybody else. I guess he didn't want to scare them. So anyway, of course, you pick up the story from there, Bernadine. In the name of fighting terrorism, we're going to have to give up our freedom.
Yeah, I want to make one comment on that too, Stan. You said air marshals. Marshals. You know, they're trying to get rid of the sheriffs, and they're trying to put marshals in their place, which means that the marshals are appointed. And then the last vestige of local control that we really have something to say about is our sheriff. And so they want to make him appointed, and in some cases they're abolishing sheriffs completely, like in the state of Connecticut. That just happened 2 years ago. They have no more sheriffs. They are all marshals. And they don't take an oath to the Constitution. They're not elected. They're not responsible to the people. They're responsible to their superiors on the federal level. That's why I picked up when you said air marshals, because it's just another segment of what they're doing.
Okay, fine. Well, why don't you just tell us your vision of what's taking place?
All right. Well, you know, I spent the day going on the web today, and I was looking up under some of the regional government arrangements that are there. I started out years and years ago objecting to regional government before I even got into the guns. The reason I moved into the guns, because I found out nobody was adequately covering them as it should be. And so today I thought I'd refresh myself and see what advancements were made, and it is just massive. And if we sit back and do nothing and think that everything's going to come out okay, we're going to find that we're going in the wrong direction. And they're building what we used to call, and it still is, a parallel government. They're building another system inside of this government, inside of this constitutional system. And, you know, it's going to come down to this. People are going to have to do something, and they're going to have to do it fast. They can't just sit back and listen to one radio talk show after another. They're going to have to participate. They're going to have to give some energy. They're going to have to do something. I'm suggesting that everybody get little groups together and take the name of a little organization. You can have 10 people and get behind the memorial, which is a new movement that I've just put together. It's a way of taking over government. Unless we take over government, unless we get inside of government, unless we get government to do what they're supposed to do, we are going to come out on the short end, and we're going to be robots, because that's what this parallel government is planning for the people. You know, they can even, the plans for that are that they can put you, once they've got the thing full rolling, it's not full rolling yet, people haven't seen nothing yet. The plan is that they can move people anywhere in the world that they want them. They're controlling the whole world. If you get into the regions, you know, a lot of people know that we've been cut up into 10 regions and sub-regions, et cetera, et cetera. That is all over the world. They've got regions in every country. And that is this massive world, new world order.
Now, of course, does this fit into the Office of Homeland Security, Bernadine?
Well, yeah, the way, and that's a facet under the parallel government. That is policy, let's say.
But what is
this new world order is a militarized government, and that's what the Homeland Security is. It's putting the military government into operation on this continent.
And, of course, it's in the name of fighting terrorism. That's
what
we're told.
Everything is done under the name of something sweet and sugary and nice. You know, Patriot Act, Victory Act, streamlining, modernizing, updating, you know, all these cutesy little terms, reforming, restructuring, modernizing. You know, this is all part of the ability to pull the wool over people's eyes. And people think that they don't have to worry that the government is there to help them. The government's going to, you know, but this is not, what is operating today is not the government. This is not the constitutional government. This is not what the founding fathers left us or expected us to protect. This is not our Bill of Rights. This is a totalitarian government where they're going to do they're going to manage every aspect of people's lives. They will have no decisions to make of their own. It'll be from cradle to grave. They'll be told every move they can make. They will not be able to have cars, and that's not wanted. They don't want you to have your own choice of religion. You will take the world religion.
Bernadine, if you tell people that they intend to take our cars away, they're not going to believe you. Why? They could never take our cars away. How can we verify that that's really what they intend to do?
Well, they can never take our guns away either, but they are writing those laws, aren't they?
Right. Well, of course, for our listeners, if you don't believe that they really intend to take our cars away, you need to get a copy of the local Agenda 21, the Santa Cruz Agenda 21 program. We have that here at Radio Liberty. It is simply an extension of the International Agenda 21, which was just by accident. Our Agenda 21 corresponds with all the other Agenda 21s throughout the world, but the Santa Cruz Agenda 21 says they want to take our cars away. Go ahead, Bernadine.
Well, I've been to meetings and I've heard them admit it. You know, one man said, what right has the state got to take away the people's cars? And the man from Caltrans in California in Sacramento said, well, actually, we were in Fresno at the meeting, but anyway, he responded and said, the state doesn't intend to take away the cars immediately. Immediately. No, not immediately.
But that's what this is all about. You see, if they take away your car, they can control your movement. They control your movement. They control you. As incredible as it may seem, there is a master plan. There really are people out there who believe in a world fascist society, and they know exactly what they're doing. They've written this up in the Sustainable Development manuals. You can read it in the Global Biodiversity Assessment Report, or we have a wonderful summary of that in my Sustainable Development syllabus. You must understand, when they talk about sustainable development, substitute the word socialism or fascism, then you understand what they're talking about, a ruling elite telling you what to do.
Well let me qualify, too. At the same meeting, he said that unless you had freight that you could not take on a bicycle, you couldn't use your car. If you were going to go to somewhere in the mountains, that would be different, where there was no buses or transportation, then that would be an exception. But outside of that, you're not going to be able to use your car. Now, another thing is they have a policy, and this is a matter of fact, that land is, there's going to be no private ownership of land. They call land a unique, has a unique nature, can't be treated as an ordinary asset that's controlled by individuals, that for the interest of society as a whole, the UN policy that there's no private ownership of land to be allowed. Well, once you don't own land, you don't own guns, you don't own yourself, you're just a robot. But anyway, I've come up with some things that we have to do before it's too late. One of the things, several things, we have to hold on to the system of sheriffs. Our sheriffs are now under threat of, they're moving in to eliminate them. We need the sheriff, and I'll go into that a little bit more later. And the memorial I have, it is a program, you might say, that I wrote it as if a state had written it. We have to get our states acting with the responsibilities that were put on them when they were made states. They have to defend us. And so this memorial, it's similar to a resolution, only a memorial is higher. If it's signed by the governor and secretary of state, it becomes a law. We have to pressure our state legislators, even though we know what they're like. I mean, there's a lot of socialists. There's so many Rhodes Scholars running this country. They're sitting in state houses as well as the federal government.
Don't forget, there's the man that the Democrats are really going to run, I think, and I may be mistaken, but that would be General Wesley Clark, a Rhodes Scholar, I believe. Probably, and I'm just, don't hold me to this, but I think he's probably going to be the Democrat nominee for the presidency running against George Bush.
Yeah, I saw that in the paper, Dr. Stan.
It's like almost as if somebody had given instructions and every major newspaper and every major magazine begins talking about the candidacy of General Wesley Smith.
Clark.
Mm-hmm. Wesley Clark. And, you know, where is his constituency coming from, and who are all the people clamoring for him to run? Why, of course, it's the establishment, the CFR, the roundtable group, the Rhodes Scholars. That's the only people behind him. But this is how you create a political candidate, and you're absolutely right. The Rhodes Scholars are every place in key positions moving us towards this world government under the control of a ruling elite run by themselves.
Yes, and you know what a Rhodes Scholar is?
Oh, I know what a Rhodes Scholar is.
Okay. Go ahead.
Well, of course, these are people who are, of course, selected from universities all across the world, primarily in English-speaking countries and in Germany. And, of course, there'll be a certain number nominated from each country and selected, and then they're sent to Oxford where they're spend their time of 3 or 4 years, and they're indoctrinated in international
socialism. They're given, is it $28,000 or $32,000 to pay for their education there? And then they're instructed, Cecil Rhodes wanted it,
right.
In world government.
Right.
And
when they come back to the United States, at least according to a book I have written in 1940 by Frank Adialet called The Vision of Cecil Rhodes, they come back to America and they join the Council on Foreign Relations.
Or they take an office some administrative, where the power is. They're moving all power under non-elected people.
Right.
But, of course, they're, look here now, you're talking about Wesley Clark. He's a Rhodes Scholar.
Sure he is.
And Clinton was a Rhodes Scholar. Well, it said in the paper a couple of nights ago that he was a Rhodes Scholar, but I see in tonight's paper when they're talking about him, I don't think I saw that he was a Rhodes Scholar. They must have dropped that.
Right, but he is.
But I have the clipping where they did admit that he was a Rhodes Scholar a couple of days ago.
Right.
But can you imagine, Dr. Stan, here we are set up with the Homeland Security. It's a military government system. That's what they're laying over the whole system here. They're grabbing all the police and all the law enforcement under them that they can. They've merged the military and the civilian law enforcement together. It goes along with the requirement in the disarmament law that they have a military government here for when they give our military, which are the troops, when they give the troops over to the One World Army, they have to have this military government. And can you imagine having a general, Clark is a former four-star general.
Right.
And who would know better than to run a military government than a general?
Or a military dictatorship.
Yeah.
But, of course, the American people don't believe it can happen. But in the name of fighting terrorism, they'll give up ever more of their individual freedom. And there are a lot of people who say, what's wrong with the Patriot Act? After all, don't we have to get these terrorists? And yet, there's not one word about Islamic terrorism in that entire the legislation. You get it, you read it, and you show me where it talks about Islamic terrorism.
Well, I'll tell you what I did for tonight's program.
Okay.
I made a list of things that we have that are rights, and we need to think about them. Is it okay if I
you
start
go right
to read
a, you go right ahead.
Gosh, there's like 16, 17 of them or so. Okay, first thing is we have a right to have weapons of self-defense and defense of our country. That's a number one right. We have a right to self-preservation. We have a right to have states. When they take away our states, which is the plan, they have these interstate compacts are part of the regional system. And incidentally, that regional system, all these things you're talking about, NAFTA, GATT, sustainable development, and all of those, all the social programs, all the economic programs, political changes, that's all a part of the regional government management. Regional government is not just military, and it is not just geographical in its realignments of borders and elimination of states. It is also controlling the people and how the people can think. That's a definite objective, is to teach the people how they want them to think and what they want them to think. So the longer we wait and the more they get a hold here, the rougher it's going to be for people to try to wake up their fellow citizens. But anyway, I was talking about the right to have states, and if that's the second right. If you don't have the states, you don't have the Constitution, because that's what the Constitution is a granting of power from the states to the federal people. Third, you have a right to elect those who take power over you. You have a right to elect. Four, you have a right to limit the power of those who you elect. You have a right to expect them to keep the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. Five, you have a right to speak out, to criticize public officials when they are exceeding the limits of their power or going in the wrong direction. Six, you have a right to limit taxation when it comes so overwhelming and where they have money to burn, where they can do all these massive things on a global scale, then you know they've got too much money. 7, you have a right to a republican form of government, not a democracy. That's what the parallel government is. That's what regional government is. That's what world government is. That's what communist government is. It is democracy. It's just another one of those little sweet words we talked about. 8, you have a right to resist tyranny. 9, you have a right to require that public officials get the consent of the governed. Consent of the governed is something that is in the Declaration of Independence. And although they have pulled tricks, like having citizen advisory committees, supposedly they represent a group of 32 million people. They pick 400 or 500 people, and they say those are going to represent 32 million. Well, the other people in the 32 million group don't even know what the 500 are doing. And so they really don't have consent, but that's a device that they have used to get around the requirement in the Declaration of Independence, and we need to call them on that. 10, we have a right to reject another form of government being brought in here over the existing government. And that, of course, is referring to the parallel government. 11, we have a right to be informed as to what is actually happening to our country. We don't have that, as you know. The mainstream news media does not tell the truth. We're not getting it on the air, and that's one of the things that we hope that the memorial will bring about a change and will demand that these things, well, this is what we're asking of the state, that they get this in mainstream media, what is happening. 12, we have a right to avoid a civil war, because eventually it's going to come to that. When people are expected to open their doors to foreign troops to come in and search their homes and go through looking for guns, if whatever they find they may want to keep. You know, I don't buy coins. I never have gotten into the coin thing, because we're in a business where we buy steel and in the welding business. And my metal has been steel, you know, for building farm equipment. But other people do have gold and jewelry and so on that they've used to hedge inflation. Those things will be searched when they send in the foreign troops. It's something to think about. 13, you have a right not to wait for the cold dead hand scenario. So that means don't waste time now. People have to do something now where they can still talk and they still have the right, you know, to address their public officials and have them listen to what our grievance is in one form or another. Of course, preferably we're talking about the memorial. 14, we have a right to maintain our checks and balance, the check and balance system, that all our safeguards are being wiped out. And this is, when we need them, turn to them, they're not going to be there. And so that's another right that we have to guard. 15, we have a right to retrieve delegated power and repeal laws that are massively destructive to the republic. It can be done two different ways other than federal. The federal government itself isn't going to do it. The states can do it. The states do have that power, and that power is mentioned in the memorial. 16, we have a right to own land. You have a right to choose your own occupation. You have a right, 17, to instruct the people who are in the seats of government, and we're paying their salaries, and we have a right to tell them what we want done, and they have an obligation to see that it is done when it is the proper thing to be doing now, which is to hold on to our constitutional system. I think I've about 17 of them there. we have a right to make those who are in office follow the law. And this is what our problem is, that they're stepping over all of our laws. Our Constitution has been superseded by world government communist constitutions, three of them I know of. They have a replacement for our Bill of Rights. It's the Communist Bill of Rights.
Well, of course, what we need to do, Bernadine, is to have the average person really understand our Constitution, understand the foundations of our freedom, and that's why we need to instruct people in what the Constitution really says, what the Declaration says, what the Bill of Rights say, and what our Founding Fathers meant when they gave us those documents. And that is so important, and this is what we're trying to do, is get people educated in the Constitution through the Institute of the Constitution. And if you know people who would be willing to teach it, we've got a great program. But you go ahead and pick up from there.
Well, the main thing about the Constitution, you can read it. It's a grant of powers. There's some real good things above George Washington's signature. They have to guarantee us a Republican form of government, not a dictatorship. They have to observe that there are states. And let me say, there's another big one in there that I can't think of right this minute. Until you get into the Bill of Rights, then you don't really hit the things that the people themselves consider the most important. But the people are not here to serve the government. The government officials are here to serve the people. And when they start taking away our guns, you know, people should know that something's gone wrong, seriously wrong. You know, Bertrand Russell, I don't know if you've read this or not, but in his book, The Impact of Science on Society and this New World Order, he said this: it's to be expected that advances in psychology will give governments much more control over individual mentality than what they have now. Education should aim at destroying free will, so that after pupils have left school, they shall be incapable throughout the rest of their lives of thinking or acting otherwise than what their schoolmasters would have wished them to act like. Diet, injections, and injunctions will combine from a very early age to produce the sort of character and the sort of beliefs that the authorities consider desirable. And any serious criticism of these powers will become psychologically impossible. Even if they are miserable, all will believe themselves happy because the government will tell them that they are so. Now that's the attitude that these people that place themselves so much more superior over their fellow men, fellow citizens. You know, this is not the way the government was supposed to be.
Well, I think, you know, that's so interesting, Bernadine, because basically, you know, I was watching tonight, they were talking about all the students who were getting these loans from government to go to college. What people don't understand is that so much of college is not education, it's indoctrination.
Yes.
To get you to believe the lies, of course, that the all-powerful government can provide for us from the cradle to the grave and make us happy. And of course, so many people who go to college will never unlearn the lies that they've learned. I was fortunate, I had been out of college for perhaps half a dozen years, when I began to realize that I'd been lied to and began to read and find out on my own. So our challenge to you is, if you have a good education, why don't you just challenge what you were taught? This is not a democracy, it's a republic. America's freedom was based upon limiting the power of government. Well, we'll be back in just a moment with Bernadine. We'll invite your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Bernadine Smith. Bernadine, why don't you get your telephone number, your website out there before we forget?
Oh, sure. My website is 3Ws dot LibertyGunRights.com. It's Liberty Gun, G-U-N, Rights, R-I-G-H-T-S, .com. And if they want to fax me and ask for any particular help or document or whatever, I'll give my fax number, which is 559-584-4084. So if they want to contact me by mail, my mailing address is Post Office Box 1776. The town is Hanford, H-A-N-F-O-R-D, Hanford, California, zip 93232. So that ought to do it. But through you, Stan, you know, they can get in touch with me. You had a man just recently call me who had been listening to your broadcast. You must have talked about the chip in the hand.
What were
you
talking
about? You told him to contact me because I did that article up on the chip in the hand.
Right.
Well, you know, there's articles you can pick up and read today where they're admitting that they've got the chip ready for implantation in humans, and they've approved of it. So, you know, what kind of a world is going to be when you've got the chip in your hand, you go to the grocery store, you have to put your hand there to check out your stuff. And, you know, years ago, Joe Hindman wrote about this, was the plan to redistribute the income of individuals. She said that it involves ceilings and floors, hemming in the income of every worker at every stage of his career, so that nobody would make too little or too much, and that computers would decide the model wage due to each worker, and the criteria that they would base how much you would be allowed was based upon your family background, your education, your occupation would be fed into the computers also, and the political wage would be determined by the computer. And you would have no more or no less than what the computer said. So, you know, this is what they're planning when they get all the guns. And that's one of the reasons that I started the Second Amendment Committee, was because it's important to hold on to the guns. Because once you lose the guns, you've lost your authority, and you have no resistance, and your sovereignty is gone. And you will, you know, you won't be able to stop any of the powers that they're taking over the people, and they will take more power than elected officials did in the past, because the parallel government, the New World Order, is to be run by appointees. You're not going to have elections, and those people don't have to worry about being reelected, and as they, you know, just invade your privacy, they don't have to worry, because there's no way you can't recall them. They weren't elected, and you can't vote them out because you have lost the voting. And that's what this New World Order is. It's a system where there is no elected representation. Now, isn't that awful?
Yep, it sure is. Well, I think that people have to understand that since the beginning of time, there's always been those who've lusted after power. But what we're seeing today is a continuation of Plato's idea of the republic of ruling elite. And, of course, this is why people of great wealth love socialism, because that centralizes all power with government, in contrast to our constitutional system, where the power of the central government is limited and it's very difficult to control the people. But if you can get the government to control the people and you can control the government, then, of course, you have absolute power. And absolute power corrupts absolutely everyone. And that's exactly what's going on today. And this is not only in America. The plan is worldwide. A one world government, a new world religion.
Well, Stan, you probably look at it like I do. I think the Dark Ages will be here again once they take all of this authority and wipe out all the resistance of the people. It's going to be Dark Ages again, and that's a pity because it will last for a long, long time before there'll be another group of people like we had in 1775 and even before when Samuel Adams and different ones were making speeches and Patrick Henry was making resolves and in the churches of what was going on with liberty and so on. It'll be a sad day when the Constitution is totally wiped out.
Amen to that. I agree with you totally. Well, our job, of course, is to utilize what we have, and we have a small network, about 59 outlets every week, where at least people are hearing some of the truth. And hopefully, as people tell people tell people, and they go onto our website, and they listen to our archive programs, and they begin to understand how these things are going on, and they begin to understand the basic philosophy of freedom, the most wonderful idea. But, of course, freedom comes from God. It doesn't come from government. God gives us freedom, and governments are created among men to ensure those God-given rights.
You're actually quoting Jefferson. Jefferson, the God that gave us life, gave us liberty at the same time.
But can the liberty of a nation be secure when the conviction has been forgotten that liberty is the gift of God?
Right. I've been defending the right for us to have sheriffs, and today I finished another article. I did so because there was a man that called me, and he said, well, I couldn't find the sheriff listed in the Constitution anywhere. And before, I think he was on a case, I won't say what his grievances were, but before I could get very far with him, call was over. And I tried to tell him it was part of the check and balance system. So I've done a new paper to go with all the other pages that I've done on the sheriff's mail out that we've been doing. And this one points out that the sheriff is not found. It's not, you can't expect to find it on the federal level. It's a position in a state. And it was carried over during the days of the colonies. They had sheriffs. They called him the High Sheriff, and he had great powers.
And we had him in England that we have remembered, the sheriff in Nottingham.
Right, right. Well, this is where it came from, and they carried it over here. Then they, after the Revolutionary War, they got in the Articles of Confederation. Well, then they were maintaining sheriffs, and they've maintained them all the way through on the level of the 13 original colonies
Sheriffs actually within the counties. That was the law enforcer in the individual counties.
Right, right. And it is important for us to hang on to the sheriff because he takes an oath to the Constitution. Unfortunately, we've got too many sheriffs that don't realize the great powers that sheriffs do have. And, this is something in addition to the general articles I've done on sheriffs, but I got to thinking today that the sheriff is obligated by his oath to see that not only the Constitution for the state which he takes, incorporated in the state constitution is the fact that the state says that it is a part of the union and the may not have those exact words, but the constitution, the federal constitution, is the supreme law of the land. They recognize the supreme law within their state constitution. And so when the sheriff takes his oath, he is taking it to both constitutions. Now, the federal constitution contains the Bill of Rights, which says that a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. So you see, the states themselves wrote that, and they would not ratify the Constitution unless that was put in there. That was to protect them as states. And a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, were there to see that that state existed. Now,
right.
Of course, the parallel government is out to get rid of those states and get rid of the guns, too, and get rid of any resistance that would go against what they're planning.
All right, let me just put out a telephone number. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you have a question or comment on what Bernadine's talking about. Go ahead, Bernadine.
Well, it's just that if the sheriff were doing what he's supposed to do, he would back the people's right to keep and bear arms, because that is a part of the federal constitution. It's so clear. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. And how many sheriffs are doing that? There's a few. Some good ones out there, like Richard Mack, Jay Prince in Montana. I'm sure there's a few others that I haven't heard of. But unfortunately, our sheriffs have been dumbed down, just like they're doing with the kids in school, that they don't even realize what rights they have. You know, they have a right. And this is what it all comes down to, Stan, is that you either are going to be a robot. The other choice you have is that you can limit the power that public officials can hold over you. And if you haven't got the nerve to limit the power that they can exert over you, then you're headed to be a robot. It just comes down to that, you know, in a nutshell. So that's why I've been trying to get people to form little groups and get behind this memorial. And it's something you take to your state legislature. It's a document that they need to endorse.
All right, fine. Why don't you tell us about the memorial? What does it involve?
Okay.
And what does it basically hope to accomplish?
Well, the purpose of it is for the state to lay down an instruction to their agent. You know, the state's created the federal government. They have authority over the federal government. The people have authority over the federal government. The people have authority over the state. And so the state could, and this has been done in the past, if the federal government gets out of hand, such as they are. I mean, whenever a government, a federal central government, decides to give away the military of the country for which they're being paid to perform duties, when they give away that military, that's treason.
You're talking about turning it over to the United Nations for...
Yeah, that's public law.
Right.
Public law 87-297 is a law, and I think most of your listeners probably know that. You probably go into that fairly often.
Well, we've told them about 7277, but I don't know that one specifically you're speaking of.
Well, that's the same. 7277 is the policy book that explains the policies of Public Law 87-297. And this is not a dream or an exaggeration. That law has been passed. Anybody can go see it in the depository library. You go into Title 22, Section 2551, and the library can help, library lady can help anybody find that law.
And what does that law actually say, Bernadine?
It talks about elimination of the armed forces and armaments of all kinds, everything you have. But it's all transferred over to this parallel government, to the world government.
Well,
the parallel government we're getting here is just like an octopus. We're getting that segment that is going to control us, but the parallel government is worldwide. And so everything's going to be in the hands of the UN, the because that now is a stand-in for the parallel government. And people will be totally disarmed on all things we've talked about, how they'll have a chip in the hand. They'll be told everything, every move to make. And that's the control. And it'll be a military government that you'll be afraid. You won't even have a First Amendment right anymore, because with a military government that does not allow free speech, people are just not going to talk anymore. So while we still have in our country, and I've used this analogy on another time, if you were to count from 1 to 10 how much we have left of our constitutional government and how much is parallel government that's running the country, out of a 1 to 10, 10 being the most of the world parallel government in operation, well, we're at about a 3 in constitutional government, but it's there. And that's an important 3 that's left. It's the right to speak. It's the right to have guns. It's the right to own land. And we have to hang in there and use those tools, the fact that we can still speak and we can retain our rights as gun owners. When the guns are gone, it'll be over. Once they get them all, and they're lining that up. You probably know about the Holt bill, where they got this kind of, it's kind of a cleanup bill over the nation, where any handgun that you haven't reported before, you have to report, and if you and be licensed, registered. If you don't, then you'll have a 15-year prison sentence, and it cannot be reversed or anything. You have to go through 15 years of jail.
Well, no, of course, has this been passed? Has this law been passed?
So last I checked on it, it's still in committee. But this is how bad it is, you know, Stan.
Well, I have no question it's bad. We just need to get people to understand there's a problem. And, of course, right now we have the Christian community solidly behind our president. You know, he's a Christian. He gets up every morning. He says his prayers, and then he reads the Bible. And so they can't believe he could be going along with anything that would take away our freedom. And, of course, once again, we have a perception. Do we know what really goes on in the White House? Of course we don't. But we know what we're told, and we know what we want to believe. It's about time people understood that the leadership of both political parties is controlled by the same people who are dedicated to world fascism.
Well, unfortunately, the president is a good actor. He's just an actor. And unfortunately, religious people are overly trusting, and they don't know, you know, how to evaluate somebody that is a con man, and that's what Bush is.
Bill Clinton used to go to church every Sunday. He's been endorsed by, you know, the people, Bill Hybel up in there in Illinois at the church that's there, one of the largest churches in Illinois, of course, endorsed by Billy Graham. So, you know, we see this with both Clinton and Bush.
Well, you know, Bush's father was the president in 1989, and when there was it wasn't a renewal, it was an amendment to this law, which you call 7277, it's really public law 87297, and it gets amendments every 2 years, it gets funds appropriated to keep it going since 1961. And in 1989, when the appropriations were in order and this little 3.5-page amendment was put out, it repeated the definition of disarmament, talking about elimination of our armed forces, turning them over to international organizations, and elimination of armaments of all kinds, etc. Now, that was signed by George Herbert Walker Bush. And, of course, the program, as you know, and your listeners that have 7277 know, the little book says, the title of it is The United States Program for General and Complete Disarmament in a Peaceful world. So when Bush, that's in there now, when he talks about having more peace, we're going to have a more peaceful world, this is what he's talking about. And when they talk about democracy, they're talking about the parallel government. The people, you know, religious people don't realize that, and they don't suspect that these sort of people would have a second dictionary, and the meanings of words as they learned them are not what these people are using them for. So democracy doesn't mean what the religious people think it means, and peace doesn't mean what they think. Peace means you're going to be completely disarmed under a military government, but they don't know that. And I don't know how you cut through and wake them up unless you take the documents to them and show it to them. I don't know, it's probably a good idea.
Well, of course, and they get those documents from you?
Yes, mm-hmm. They could.
And how big, how lengthy is this public law, 87-297?
Well, it would be real extensive if you put all the amendments that went with it, you know, all the additions since 61, but I have the basic outline, and as Kennedy, the one that Kennedy signed, I have that form, and I have the 7277, and then I've also got the more extensive book, which is over 7277, which is called The Blueprints of the Peace Race. And when they see all that and the diagram showing how we will lose our army in three stages until we have a zero military put out by the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, it is possible that maybe they will catch on that when we have no defenses and there are plans for a radical, strange world religion of worshiping the earth rather than a divine being, then maybe they will catch on. I don't know.
Well,
I just hope.
I tell you what I think. I think that the thing that's going to get their attention first is the realization that we're shipping their jobs overseas. We have a large farm economy here in California. A lot of the farmers are going to lose their subsidies because the World Trade Organization, these people have been, you know, getting comfortable. Some fellow, 2,000 acres of corn, he gets about $300,000 every 4 years from the government, maybe $80,000 or $90,000 a year for fertilizers. Suddenly that's gone. He's not going to be able to compete with the farmers of Africa. And we're going to see a dramatic lowering of the living standards of the people in this country. Only then are people going to begin to take a second look at what's going on. The problem, Bernadine, is the American people are too comfortable today.
Well, you know, you can see the Chinese moving in. They've got George Air Force Base, and they've got, there's other places. I think they're in Mare Island, and there's other places in California where they've taken over that used to be bases, and they're going into the Panama Canal. They're lining up at the border of Canada and USA, and there's a proposal to have, I think there's 7 states that they're going to bring in little Chinese communities in the Deep South area. They're going to have in several of those states they want to, this was something they wanted to do under Clinton, and I don't know if the agreements went through or not, but there were plans to do it. And when they see that we're being taken by people that are not Christian, a lot of them are just complete atheists, and we're, you know, the atheists are our most favorite nations today. Maybe they'll wake up. I don't know.
Well, I think that people should, all they have to do is see that the government is intentionally, purposely, maliciously flooding this country with illegal aliens. And now, I have nothing wrong with aliens, but we bring in too many. There are no jobs for the rest of us. And, of course, the whole idea is get these people in, not teach them English, become a bilingual and then a trilingual nation. And, of course, this is all divisive. They're intentionally dividing this nation. They know exactly what they're doing.
Well, we can't accommodate an overwhelming presence because it takes time to make Americans of them. There's a system here, and they're not, in tune with the deviousness of, well, look at Schwarzenegger is, he went to, a couple of weekends or so ago, he went over to the Rothschilds and spent a weekend in the mansion over there in England.
Well, of course, he's being run to prevent Tom McClintock from getting the governorship, because the last thing they want is somebody who believes in America to become the governor of the state of California.
Well, that's right. Well, in the meantime, my hopes are in the memorial, so if people want to learn a little bit more about this movement, I would urge them to plan to get a little group together and stand up for their constitution and see if we can't stop this horrible thing that's just about to come down with what the Fabians call the hard blows. So, you know, it's just, you can see the handwriting on the wall. If something isn't done while we can still talk, why, it's going to be too late.
Well, all we can do is do our best and rely upon the Lord, but at least we have a voice, and I appreciate everything you've done for so many years. Of course, our guest has been Bernadine Smith, and she's been on the front lines of this battle for how many years, Bernadine?
Well, we won't mention that.
Oh, but for an awful long time.
Yeah, it's an awful long time.
So, again, if you want to get hold of her, why, you can call her at 559-584-4084. Is that right?
Yeah, that's just send a fax and let me know what they need, and I'll see what I can do to help them. And I can send the memorial if they want to get into waking up their sheriff. We have a sheriff's package. If they would send me an envelope, it's pretty hard for me to, you know, continue on the cost of all this. If they'd send a 10x12 brown a strong envelope and put like $4.50 worth of postage on, I can send them a terrific package.
And
they can get started, starting their own little group and, going after, somebody in the legislature that they can trust and just showing them what's going on and begging for help. You know, once we ask them for help, I'm gonna put this, out for you. Normally I don't talk about this on the air, but when you know there's treason and you tell it to a public official, if he denies to help you, then he is guilty of a crime, and it's concealment of treason, and of course the fancy word for it is misprision of treason.
All right, we're out of time. God bless you. Thank you so much, Bernadine.
Okay, bye.
Good night. Okay, well, that was Bernadine Smith. I hope you enjoyed our conversation, and it's a good thing the hour is over, because I'm almost out of a voice. But under any circumstances, pray for America. Pray for our leaders and for our ministers. We hope many of you will join the Radio Liberty family. That's how we're able to progressively expand our coverage out across America on 59 different outlets every week. But we need your help. Remember 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so on Monday, we'll be back again. Until then, may the Lord be with you.